Coming up on this week's book show and Gish Jen's latest, The Resistors, we meet Gwen, who has a golden arm, and her teens find her happily playing in an underground baseball league. The dystopian novel is the story of an America that seems ever more possible. It's also the story of a family struggling to maintain its humanity. Gish Jen, on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In Gish Jen's latest, The Resistors, the time is not so long from now. The place, Auto America. The land is half underwater. The internet, one part artificial intelligence, one part surveillance technology, and oddly human, even funny. The people divided, the angel fare netted, have jobs, and literally occupy the high ground. The surplus live on swampland, if they're lucky, and in the water, if they're not. In the novel, we meet Gwen, who has a golden arm. Her teens find her happily playing in an underground baseball league. The Resistors is the story of an America that seems ever more possible. It's also the story of one family struggling to maintain its humanity and normalcy in circumstances that threaten their every value, as well as their very existence. Gish Jen is the author of four previous novels, a story collection, and two works of nonfiction, the latest of which was The Girl at the Baggage Claim, explaining the East-West culture gap. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Gish Jen back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, let us begin with what brings you to a place like this of writing of this time and wanting to look in a somewhat dystopian way of where we are, maybe not so far from now.
Well, you know, I was writing this, I sat down to write this book in 2017. I just finished The Girl, The Baggage Claim. And I was at a very particular point in my life, I will say, which is to say that I was newly an empty nester. My daughter had just gone off to school. And so it was a moment at which I was both very oriented to this future, because I just sat through freshman orientation where the word future comes up like every 15 seconds. And also a time when I had just finished telling my daughter, you know, have fun, take risks, explore. And I said that so many times that, you know, as I sat down to my new freedom, I thought, well, maybe I should have fun and take risks and explore. So it's a kind of a very heady time for me, a time when I felt that I could do anything that I want to from a writing point of view, but also a time that because I had a young person going out into the world, I was simultaneously very hopeful about her and her prospects and what she and other members of her generation would do, but also concerned. 2017, as you may or may not remember, was the year when we had many huge storms. It was a time when Trump had been in office for 10 months then, and I think it was becoming increasingly clear that we were in an experiment, shall we say, in democracy. That's putting it kindly. But in any case, there was a sense that, you know, sort of our whole governmental apparatus was kind of in flux. And it was a time also when, you know, AI was beginning to take on, you know, I wouldn't say it was taking on a sinister aspect exactly, but it was becoming clear that technology was going to be two-faced, you know, that there were going to be big positive things, but there was a potential there for abuse. And that was the year when Facebook chatbots started talking to each other in a language which was just not human and which we could not understand. And that freaked a lot of people out. There was a big conversation between Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk then about AI and what this could mean for us as humans. So all of that was on my mind as I sat down to write this book. And lo and behold, I wrote a book that was very, very different than anything that I had written before that.
It appears, though, that there is a kind of skip in the step, if you will, of your dystopia.
Well, that's right. You know, there's a way in which this book is kind of a buoyant dystopia, or as somebody said to me the other day, it's funny because it's once a dystopia and kind of a utopia, because this family, as they resist this new dispensation, actually create their own little world, and their own little world is happy, it is warm, it is human-centered. You know, they do a lot of knitting and reading and, of course, baseball. And in fact, it's more egalitarian not only than the world that surrounds them in the future, but maybe even than the world we live in now. You know, of course, baseball figures very largely in this book. You know, baseball, the great national pastime, and it's so much a metaphor for American democracy. And yet, if we look at baseball as it is actually practiced, of course, it's quite gendered, you know. So we have a national pastime, which was emblematic of all that's American, and yet women do not participate in it at the highest level. And so this family actually makes a world where baseball is something that everybody can play, including girls.
And what is lovely in that, in this world that you have created, that at the core is, as you said, baseball is very much a part of this novel, but it is a good old-fashioned baseball novel, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm crossing to a couple of different genres here, but yes, but I am borrowing from the baseball genre, baseball novel genre, which I have to say was a lot of fun. I mean, I think that if I weren't in such a happy time of my life, maybe I would have frozen up a little bit and thought, oh my God, you know, so many great writers have written such big baseball novels, you know. Am I really up to trying to make a dent in this very august tradition? But such was my mood that I just went ahead and did it without thinking, like, oh my God, Philip Roth, Don DeLillo, you know, Bernard Malamud. You know, I tried not to think about any of that stuff. And I tried not to think about what guy territory it is, really.
When it comes to the narrator of the novel being Gwen's father, how did you make that decision? Which is interesting because the father is not always with Gwen.
Yeah. Well, I made that decision because as it became clear to me that I had two very strong characters, meaning this very prominent and effective lawyer, and also this pitching prodigy, just the novelistic challenge of making these two characters plausible meant that I had to have a kind of an ordinary mortal in there, right? Because, you know, you can't have a pitching prodigy going on about, you know, and I'm such a great pitching prodigy, you know, I think, wow, look at this arm, I can hit anything. You know, the more somebody like that talks about how great they are, the less we believe them, right? You know, you have to have a kind of a witness character. And so, like, and ditto for the lawyer, you know, so if we're to believe that she is really a very extraordinary advocate, we need a witness character. And I guess, you know, maybe I could have written this where I had a mom, you know, supporting her super-duper lawyer husband and her super-duper athlete son. But of course, you know, as a good feminist, I could not do that. So that left me with the father being the ordinary mortal, supporting these two extraordinary women. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. The name of the new novel is The Resistors. It is published by Knopf. Gish Jen is our guest on this week's book show. I'm curious as to the world that you create. How much of that world do you know going in the sense of mapping that out and saying, okay, I have this idea for these characters, and now I'm going to put them in this place?
Honestly, I just kind of made it up as I went along. I mean, I was really just out to have a great time. And I think that comes across, you know.
It does. Yeah, very much so.
And very happily for me, I was writing at a time when I had lots of stretches of unbroken time. And so there is a way in which, you know, what we need as writers is to be in a kind of dream state. Or at least as fiction writers, I should say. And a lot of people have asked me about the difference between writing nonfiction and writing fiction. And one of the things I said was that, you know, you can write nonfiction when you're fully awake. But fiction, you have to be a little asleep. And moreover, I find that the longer you can kind of just stay in this dream state, the easier it is to work, and the easier it is to make the stuff up, you know? And so, honestly, this stuff came very, very naturally. I did not do any world-building exercises or anything like that. I just allow myself to dream and to have fun. Well, you know, I will say that, you know, the fun, as you may gather, there's a fair amount of worry there, too. I mean, worry as a citizen and also worry as a parent, you know, and I was interested in capturing some of that worry, the worry that I myself felt as, you know, as I had a daughter, budding freshman, going out into the world. And I will say that, you know, you asked me a little earlier about, you know, the fact that there are parts of the book which are about Gwen's experience, but we don't follow Gwen there. But, you know, I wanted to kind of capture the feeling that many, many parents have of being fantastically interested in the experience of a child, but really having very, very limited access to it. You know, as you know, I don't want to give away too much, but the father does bug the daughter. And I would say that 100% of parents would love to be able to do that. I don't know, maybe there's an exception out there someplace, but I don't think there are too many.
You have created the world where there are two classes of people, the netted and the surplus, as I went into a little bit of detail, as I said in the introduction. It is really just a version of the have and have nots, right?
Yes, taken to an extreme, right? Because they have, you know, in this case, the have nots, they don't have jobs. And so they have a basic income. And I will point out that I did write this before Andrew Yang. But I gave them a basic income. But of course, the netted are not really much interested in a class that is not producing and that costs them. And they're not interested in that cost growing. So to be a surplus person means, among other things, that you're subject to policies like the one chance policy. They're trying to get these people to not procreate, right? So they're only allowed to have one pregnancy, and, you know, they're harassed in other ways as well. So that, you know, things are pretty bad in our country right now, if you think about income inequality, but they are not quite this bad, right?
Right. But I'm certainly not the first person to say this to you, I'm sure, but all of this is very plausible when you read it. I mean, none of this seems like it's very far away.
Yeah, well, you know, Ann Patchett did call this book a cautionary tale, and I think that was a very apt description. It's not a prediction, but it is something which is plausible. And, of course, my great hope as a writer is that people will read it, be simultaneously, you know, they would simultaneously root for the resistors, right? But also think about whether they need to resist some things as well. And my great hope is that the net effect will be that my book will, that they will actually do something and that my book will be consigned to the dustbin of history forthwith, you know? I really mean that quite sincerely. So if, you know, people were to read my book and to think, wow, you know, what are we doing in terms of our privacy? You know, should we not do something more about income inequality and do it now? I would be more than gratified.
So to stay with that and look at technology for a moment, tell us about Aunt Nettie, which plays a large part in the book, and this extension of what really is sort of the overlord, right?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, we've all read 1984 and we've all envisioned, you know, a surveillance state as involving a big brother, which is a very frightening figure. You know, in my book, we do have a surveillance state, and everything is being mediated, though not through a big brother, but something that's more like a big mother. You know, so Aunt Nettie is seductive. You know, she's consumer friendly. If you imagine today we have 4G internet, most of us, there's 5G being rolled out. So if you can imagine like a 9 or a 10G, you know, what that might look like, well, that's very likely to have aspects of AI rolled into it, right? And also some automation. And just as we today can't really live our lives without the internet, I mean, the internet does mediate everything. Similarly, in this world, Aunt Nettie, this 9 or 10G, whatever it is, which is kind of an Internet of Things, too, I will say, because, of course, many of the things that we have, like Alexa, are now actually rolled into the Internet.
Right.
And this Alexa-like presence is smart. As in our present life, there are positive aspects to this. So, the surplus are being surveilled. That's the bad news. The good news is that, these are auto houses that self-clean. So it's not all terrible. And certainly you can see how people would have been seduced into a state where basically they have allowed themselves to be surveilled, really because it came with associated conveniences.
So if you have this idea of sending your child to school and they realize that they've forgotten their homework or their lunch or their coat, you can send that to them via a drone. But obviously there's also very much a downside to that technology and that surveillance.
Yeah. So in this book, if some child says to his or her classmate, God, I'm feeling kind of cold because they're being surveilled, their parents instantly know, and the parents can instantly order a coat, which they know the child will like because the child has been using one of these, how do I look type apps. And so they know exactly what the coat should be, and then they can have a drone delivered. That's the good news, right? The bad news is that maybe your parents know way more about you than you might like them to know.
Let us talk for a moment about Gwen and the makeup of her. She is part Black, part Asian, part white. And I'm interested in the thought process of that makeup and looking at this character and what she goes through.
Well, let me take the first part first. So in this world, and there is a group called, by the way, called Auto Americans Against Apartheid. So, it does look a little apartheid-like, right? But the line between the knitted and the surplus is not the color line that we see today, because there are many surplus who are white. Although it is also true that most of the knitted are white. But on the have-not side, you have whites, and then you have many people who are, some kind of mix, And I think that that's just projecting forward from, the current trends. I mean, there are many, many, many biracial people, multiracial people. And I do think that looking forward, we will have more. That's probably a good thing in my view. But my point is that, this line is a different line than the line that we have now. And also many people with jobs, with white collar jobs, might find themselves on the wrong side of this line as well. That, again, is not a prediction exactly, but that is something that could happen because, AI is very, very, very powerful.
Looking at the idea of the racial makeup of Gwen, the opposite of that is the netted and the flaxen fair.
Yeah, I have to say that was actually a typo, and that should have been Angel Fair. And I realized that one Flaxen Fair somehow made it through, and so now that's become a thing. But that was actually unintentional. I probably
because
took it out.
Angel Fair is very much a part of it as well. But
it's really because Flaxen Fair seems to indicate that they look a certain way, and what I really meant was that that they are Caucasian. And they refer to it in a different way, and that it has a kind of connotation that is not so much a description of exactly how they look, but that that they are kind of a privileged class, and that it's associated with their appearance, but it's not like they've evolved to look very different than the people today or anything like that. They're just Caucasian in my conception of them.
Gish Jen is our guest in this week's book show. The new novel is The Resistors. It is published by Knopf. The second part of the novel is called The Underground Baseball League. And that is important because Gwen really does have to go underground to play. Talk a little bit about that dynamic, why she does indeed have to go underground.
Well, what happens is that as it slowly dawns on her parents that their child has really quite a gift. It dawns on them that, she needs she needs a team, and then her team needs other teams to play against, and so they start this league. But because, among other things, the Netted have set up fields for the surplus, but the fields are emanating bad things, chemicals that, you know, they're not really sure what it is, but they do know that kids who play on these fields become enfeebled. They, you know, they become sick, so they don't want to play on those. So they have to seek out places to play. And they have to be secretive about it so that Aunt Nettie doesn't know that they are doing this because unlawful assembly is against the law. So they find actually, you know, it's not literally underground in the sense it's underground in the sense that it's sub rosa, but they're actually playing in some of the marooned places. So what's happened is there's been so much flooding that there are many office parks and other things that have just kind of gotten stranded by the flooding. And some of these places are pretty heavily guarded, you know, by their former property owners, but some of them aren't. And so they found, you know, they kayak around and they scout out these places that are safe to play. And the parents do that. And then they go and they have their games there. Of course, the whole thing in one way is very sinister, but as you can also imagine, you know, it's kind of fun for the parents to kayaking around, finding these places and, you know, all the systems that enable this play to go on, you know, complete with orange slices and all the kinds of things that we associate with Little League are actually a lot of fun. You know, as the subterfuge is kind of fun. There's a lot of signaling involved and so on. And there's a way in which the games are fun. And then the game of setting up the games is also fun.
I certainly can be accused often of reading into things, but it does seem to me this idea that Gwen is so good, and through all of this, co-ed baseball is becoming a new Olympic sport. And let us remember once again that Gwen is a really, really good baseball player. So there is a real want for her to cross over and go into the Netted world. That, to me, says a lot about our sports culture, that we have a lot of rules, but we're willing to bend them if you can play sports really well.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't thought of, in my mind, this wasn't so much about our real-world sports situation, though, of course, there is a huge gap, I don't need to tell you, between kind of sports as the commercial activity that it can be and sort of the sports of our imagination, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just have to look at all the cheating scandals and so on. So, you know, but anyway, this was not supposed to be, you know, a critique of Major League Baseball. But I do think that, you know, baseball in my book and, or, you know, the baseball that I was writing about is this kind of, you know, the American ideal, you know, it has to do with the level playing field and the idea that everybody should have a chance at bat. And the idea that we can have an arena that is governed by rules that we all agree on that finally have the effect of bringing out the best in us, you know. That we can have a little pastoral space in the middle of all of our urban craziness, that we can nevertheless carve out this sacred space in which we kind of remember what we were about and remember, you know, a ritual space that's, you know, that like I say, is, you know, has a sacred function, and that we will stand by that.
Without giving anything away of just the overall sense of when you start something like this with a character and a family, do you want them to be okay in the end?
Well, you know, as a writer, you must put them in real danger.
Right.
You know, you must put them in real danger. And honestly, when I write, I don't know what's going to happen myself until I get to the end. I don't want to give the end away, which
of course not.
It's not a strictly happy ending, I will say. But, you know, to me, there must be something real at stake. You know, you must genuinely, in your heart of hearts, not know how things are going to turn out. As Flannery O'Connor said, if you don't surprise yourself, you're not going to surprise anybody else. And so, you know, I didn't know. As a writer, you have hopes. I mean, because I am borrowing from the baseball novel genre, you know, I knew that I wanted to have a big game at the end. I did not know how the game would turn out. But what I did understand as a writer is that however it turned out, it must surprise me and surprise the reader and must kind of transcend the genre in some way, you know? So it's got to be an end where, Even somebody who has read a million baseball books and has sat through a million baseball games would nonetheless be surprised at what happens in this particular baseball game. And like I say, and also that it has kind of opened up onto some other vista that was unanticipated. So I guess to say is I understand the task, and I don't understand either how I'm going to solve it or what's going to happen.
I may be projecting here, but it seems as though, given what we have discussed previously, that you must have been excited at the prospect as you're writing the novel to get to that point where you get to write about the big game.
Yeah, I was. You know, it's not anything that I ever thought that I would ever do in my lifetime. I mean, I myself cannot throw, I can't throw a ball 20 feet, much less anything like what Gwen can do. So there's a lot of vicarious pleasure in it. And similarly, just as I can't throw a ball, I certainly did not know that I could write such a game or a book leading up to such a game. So the whole thing was quite a gamble. But, in the best way, the same way that the batter just doesn't know, will he or she be able to hit that ball out of the park? You can't possibly know until that split second. Marianne Moore has a wonderful poem about baseball, sort of talking about baseball's like writing, because you just don't know what's going to happen and you don't know what you're going to do. So I was kind of like, any one of the players in this book as I was writing the book.
You mentioned at the very beginning that you came out of this, you came to this project after coming out of writing The Girl at the Baggage Claim. Did that set up a thought process or where an idea of where we were and that you weren't going to write nonfiction again, but you would write, you would sort of be in that headspace?
Yeah, there is a way in which some of the ideas in The Girl at the Baggage Claim kind of primed the pump, if you will, for me to write this book. Because I was writing about, a difference between the self that we have here in the industrialized West, and particularly in America, this very individualistic self, and a more interdependent self, which dominates in the rest of the world, even in Europe, and certainly has dominated, throughout history. And one of the features of the other self, which, is kind of one of my, I see myself as very much a hybrid, kind of like Gwen, but one of the features of this other self, which is part of myself, not all of myself, but part of myself, is that it's not that interested in categories. It's much more interested in morphing and flexibility. Like I say, it's not interested in hard boundaries of any kind. So it's, this is, if you know anything about, Eastern thought, it's always about a river. Nothing is ever fixed. And if you look at a lot of foreign films, especially from the East, but in other parts of the world, too, you'll see a lot of interest in morphing. And I think there's just a way in thinking about that self, it helped me give myself permission to write a book that borrowed from so many different genres. Because it is definitely a shape-shifting book. And there's just a way in which maybe I understood better, too, the ways in which this did not maybe sit so well with, kind of literary standards as, the dominant literary standards of our time. Although what I also understood was that it was emanating from a very, very important part of me. And that also that I thought that I could make it into something which was at once both individualistic and interdependent and both kind of something which served a purpose and that also was autotelic, all of those things all at once. But I think that if I had not written actually not only The Girl with the Baggage Claim, but also the book that preceded that, Tiger Writing, Art, Culture, and the Interdependent Self, I don't think I would have been able to frame it myself intellectually and therefore feel free to give myself the permission to do what was finally just mine to do.
The novel is an absolute joy. It is entitled The Resistors by Gish Jen. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.